This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator and the editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters. They're published by the Hanna News Service, and he joins us from time to time with updates on the gaming industry here in the Hoosier State and news of politics, too, since that comes under his purview. And Ed, as always, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Hey, great to be with you, Chris. Because we're going to be maybe even talking a little bit of sports wagering, does that mean I can talk about the White Sox pitching rotation possibilities?
Well, they are going to play baseball eventually, I suppose. So I guess you could always throw that out there, too, if you want. But we definitely want to talk about sports wagering, yes, to be sure. Bring us up to date. It's only been a few weeks, really, quite literally, since the time that Governor Holcomb allowed casinos to reopen here in Indiana as the shutdown ended from the pandemic. Of course, they had to have time to make all the retooling that was necessary to be able to meet the guidelines. But fill us in on how things seem to have gone. And maybe we should start out first with a quick primer for our listeners that aren't aware of what, in general, casinos here in Indiana, in particular up here in the region, had to do to get ready to bring people back in?
Oh, big task, Chris, big task. The casinos have essentially been shut or had essentially been shut for 3 months, from the middle of March, March 16th, until June 15th. And in order to get back up and running, the casinos had to establish individual property-by-property protocols for how they were going to handle literally everything from the cash management to patron ingress and egress, how the games were going to be conducted, how are they were going to establish and enforce social distancing, the kind of sanitation, the extent of the sanitation that they were going to apply at their properties. All of those things had to be established in written plans. The casinos had to prove to the Gaming Commission that they would be able to implement those things. And it wasn't until literally, you know, about 5 days before the casinos actually reopened that the Gaming Commission approved the last of the casino plans. So there were some very detailed kinds of things that the casinos told the state they were going to do. And, you know, you almost see the old, like, Sherman and Peabody cartoon with the guy at the end of the parade following up with the broom behind everybody. You know, it's almost like that, where, you know, literally when somebody moves off of a stool in front of a slot machine, which is socially distanced from another machine, you know, somebody's there and wiping off the buttons and getting ready for the next patron, wiping down the seats. And then you've got the plexiglass partitions between the table game players and the dealers, and you got people wearing masks now at all of the Caesars properties and certainly at all of the other properties at the table game. So it's a very different environment.
Now, if they just had the other casinos other than the Caesars ones, which, of course, we're talking, at least in our terms up here, is the Horseshoe Casino in Hammond, at the ones that are owned by the other operators, are they following through in more than just having their dealers wear masks or having the patrons at the table games wear masks?
Well, they're encouraging the patrons to wear masks, and all of the other employees are essentially wearing masks. And, you know, you mentioned that the Caesars property, the Horseshoe property in Hammond, and that's something that we probably ought to talk about as well outside of the context of the new protocols, but looking at what's going to happen going forward.
Yeah.
Because the Gaming Commission on July 10th is going to be considering the merger application by Eldorado Resorts, Inc., which owns Tropicana in Evansville, and Caesars Entertainment Corporation, which owns Horseshoe Casino Hammond, Caesars Southern Indiana in Harrison County, and the two former racinos, the Indiana Grand Racing and Casino in Shelbyville and Hoosier Park Racing and Casino in Anderson. And the Federal Trade Commission ruled just last week that the merger could go ahead with a couple of divestitures that had not been proposed by the companies in a couple of other states, but did not say anything specific about Indiana. But I've learned that the Indiana Gaming Commission has put together a package with Eldorado and Caesars under which when the merger is consummated, assuming it is consummated, that Eldorado and Caesars, that combined company, will divest two of their Indiana properties.
Wow.
And we're not quite sure yet which ones they will be, but I don't think that Horseshoe Casino Hammond will be one of them. But I think that you're probably looking at the two southernmost properties as being prime candidates for divestiture. The Caesars Southern Indiana property, which is facing a lot of competition from new gaming opportunities in Louisville, particularly from Churchill Downs, Inc., which is building all kinds of new historical horse wagering facilities, and the Tropicana Evansville in Evansville, which is kind of in a discrete market, not a lot of opportunity for real growth there. There's not a whole lot of money invested in it. They essentially paid about $50 million to move that on land a couple of years ago, so it's not the kind of investment that you've seen at Hammond or at some of the other properties more recently. So I think that that's probably a fairly easy one for them to divest as well. So you're going to see some change in the Hoosier casino industry that's going to be related to Caesars, which is the parent company of Horseshoe Casino Hammond, sometime in the between now and the end of the year.
Does it seem like that we're going to see more regional operators? Like in this case, you mentioned about the shift, that it may be that Evansville and Southern Indiana may kind of link up with the casino proposals in Louisville because they happen to be in the same general region. They're south of US 40, literally.
Well, I think Churchill Downs would certainly be interested in getting into the Indiana casino market. They've got some other properties in greater northern Kentucky and Ohio. Mm-hmm. They're also affiliated with the biggest competitor to Horseshoe Casino Hammond. They're the majority owner now of the Rivers Casino in Des Plaines. So the opportunity to kind of fill in the gap between Kentucky, Ohio, and Illinois would perhaps be attractive to Caesars. To Churchill, particularly, you know, at the right price. And while, you know, this isn't necessarily a fire sale, it is effectively a forced sale, and it's not always easy to get the best price for a property in a situation like that. So, yeah, it could be very attractive to Churchill, as could just another smaller regional operator. You know, you've got a lot of those floating around the Midwest, and the opportunity to get into one of those smaller markets for them, you know, might be attractive. But you know, there's also the prospect that a company like, for example, Boyd Gaming, which owns the Blue Chip Casino and Belterra Casino Resort in Switzerland County, might also make a play for another property in Indiana. Mm-hmm. But the big concern to the Indiana Gaming Commission, and this is kind of interesting, was the whole question of market concentration. And if you remember in 2019, the legislature passed a law that said that, you know, we think going forward, the question of undue market concentration should be a factor considered by the commission in any kind of change of ownership situation. But the legislature, in passing that law, basically said nothing about what they meant by that in debate or in the actual statutory language. They just talked about, you know, undue economic concentration, and that was it. And they left it up to the commission, and the commission's really not had to deal with that yet. So we don't know whether the legislature or the commission really was thinking about, okay, there's too much of one company concentrated in one particular area of the state, or they control too much of the market in something just beyond the state of Indiana, for example, you know, looking into the southeastern Indiana casinos and the Cincinnati market, or the northwest Indiana casinos and the Chicago market. So we don't know whether they were talking about that or whether they were just talking about statewide in general. And so it's going to be interesting to see what the commission says on July 10th in discussing this undue economic concentration matter, because if you look at what the market looks like today, there's already a lot of concentration just in the Caesars properties. the Caesars properties in the months leading up to the closure in March, from September through February of this year, they were bringing in more than half of the state revenues from all 13 properties, just those four Caesars properties. In February alone, the last full month of gaming in the state, the Caesars properties accounted for almost 54% of the statewide revenues. Now, when you take the El Dorado property in Evansville and you add that to the Caesars properties, you're looking at basically 57 to about 61% of all the state revenues that would be concentrated in one owner with those five properties. I think that may be something that kind of flashed that red light in front of the Gaming Commission and made them say, yeah, this may be a little bit too much for one owner. You know, we want to be able to have some control over them. If they do something wrong, we don't want somebody to be too big to fail, those kinds of considerations. So I think that's something that's going to be very interesting to watch in a week or so.
I was going to say we're liable to see this come up here at this July meeting when they do have to bring up the question of the merger.
Absolutely, yeah. And that will be the main point of contention and questioning at that meeting. You know, what properties are going to be divested, why those properties were selected, why the commission told El Dorado and Caesars that they wanted to see that kind of divestiture.
Well, it's always interesting to see what happens when you talk about geese that lay golden eggs and not, you know, following through on the triteness, I suppose, from that. We talk about that basket holding all those golden eggs and who's going to hold the basket, to be sure.
There was concern, you know, when Caesars bought the Centaur tracks that, you know, the company might just be a little bit too big to kind of get the state's disciplinary arms around, you know, if they did something, you know, that if the company were to be disciplined, it could cost the state a lot of tax dollars because they controlled so much revenue. So I think this is a response by the commission to that kind of criticism and questioning.
Now, we mentioned at the beginning of our conversation here, at least an allusion to sports betting. Is there anything new to report? Is it holding forth? We know that it's not done as well as they had hoped, and then, of course, with the fact that the casinos in general had to stay closed because of the stay-at-home order.
You know, I think it's done as well as everybody had expected, and perhaps even better. But the problem was there's just nothing left to bet on when the leagues literally closed down, you know, in the middle of March as well, starting with the NBA and the NHL. And then, you know, Major League Baseball was unable to get started. And there literally were no events left for, no domestic events at least, left for people to bet on. The overseas soccer leagues, you know, ceased play. And, you know, for a while, the big deal was table tennis, ping pong. And then the folks over at ESPN started investigating and discovered that some of these events that were being sanctioned by the different state gaming commissions, including Indiana, didn't seem to necessarily be on the up and up, and so the commission started to pull the authorization for wagering on those events. But, you know, you had Korean baseball brought into the mix. Just this week, the Gaming Commission approved betting on Japanese baseball and on a bunch of other overseas basketball leagues, as well as that TNT basketball tournament that's guaranteeing a prize of at least $1 million in a winner-take-all format, and something that's going on through, I think, about July, 14th? I think there's a finals in Columbus, Ohio. So there are all kinds of other events, but, you know, everybody wants to bet on collegiate and pro football. They want to bet on baseball. They want to bet on the NBA. And in Northwest Indiana, at least, they want to bet on the NHL.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you really don't have an opportunity to do that, you know, there's nowhere for the dollars to flow. So once the leagues start getting back in track here again in July, I think you're going to see a tremendous surge of wagering on the mobile apps in particular. And you're going to see the dollars get back to the levels that they were before. And, you know, the only question that I think people need to ask is, well, what happens if, you know, the NBA or the NHL or Major League Baseball is forced to shut down again? What happens if collegiate football doesn't get up and running? And, you know, there are a lot of questions about whether that's going to happen. You know, then we could be in the same kind of situation. But then that just means that this one little sector of the casino industry, the gaming industry, is in the same place as, you know, every other business in the country, essentially, at least in the entertainment end of things, entertainment and hospitality end. And, you know, everybody's in that same sinking boat again.
Well, we only have a couple minutes or so left in our opportunity to talk today, and I wanted to at least bring up talking more about entertainment, I suppose, to some. It's how the virtual political party conventions went. What's your opinion about how the Democratic and the Republican parties did with their Indiana virtual conventions this time around?
Well, they're not over yet. At least the Republican convention isn't over yet because we don't have the voting in. I think that comes in, July 10th also. A lot of stuff happening on July 10th for the voting on the nomination for Attorney General. I don't think that a whole lot of people really paid attention to the two conventions. You know, there's a station in Indianapolis that has a statewide network that broadcasts around the state, but there doesn't seem to have been a whole lot of attention directed toward it. I think what was perhaps more interesting was that a number of different party organizations, like the Allen County Republican Party, the Vandenberg County Republican Party, they established viewing parties, socially distanced viewing parties, around the events. So they had like mini live conventions. And in fact, the Allen County Republican Party brought in or was able to attract all four of the Republican AG candidates live at their little confab during the convention evening. So there are some unique twists on this, and I think it's an experiment that can be learned from. I don't know that the party leaders would necessarily want to repeat the experience except for the cost savings. But, you know, I think the jury is still going to be out depending upon how the Republican vote goes for AG. A lot of people are going to be looking to see whether people voted for one candidate on all four ballots or whether they split their votes between ballots to see just how effective this was, what kind of what this portends for any kind of future ranked choice voting in any kind of context might be. And whether there really is the need for, in cases where you've got a multiple ballot election, for people to kind of congregate in meeting rooms and catch each other in the hallway between ballots and cut deals, because that could not be done on these mail ballots. So a lot of differences in what we've seen between what we saw this year from the past, and I think the jury is definitely still out on whether it was an improvement, whether it's something that can be improved upon, or whether it's best to go back to, you know, the way that things were before, if the new normal will allow for that.
Well, it looks like we'll have to pick this up again with our next conversation, which I hope is soon, and we'll have more to talk about, certainly on the political end, I would imagine, before too long, but if we get caught up on the gaming industry end, too, and especially when we come about after the Gaming Commission meeting here in July.
Yeah, and the White Sox pitching rotation.
That's right. That, too. Thank you very much for spending time with us to go over everything today, though.
Thanks for inviting me, Chris.
Ed Feigenbaum is the creator and editor of the Indiana Gaming Insight and the Indiana Legislative Insight newsletters that are published by the Hanna News Service. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. On June 18th, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected President Donald Trump's effort to end DACA, which provides legal protections for some 650,000 young immigrants who came to the United States as children. The High Court ruled that DACA was illegally rescinded by the Trump administration, which the court said had failed to provide an adequate reason to justify ending the program. Supporters of immigration and of the Dreamers, as they are called, are considering this a celebration, but it is a muted celebration to some. In fact, our next guest on the program said it was just a kind of a kick of the can down the road. Alfredo Estrada, what's your thoughts on the immigration decision that the nation's high court has handed down?
Hey, Chris, how you doing? Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
You know, that quote was taken in a long conversation we had with one reporter. And what I mean by that is that the Supreme Court's ruling, which states that the administration violated the APA in only taking consideration the deference or the prosecutor discretion element of DACA, not the other factors such as ability to travel or work, Social Security benefits and Medicare benefits, their violation. It also ended with them remanding it back to DHS to, if they deem fit, take another stab at the rescission of DACA. So, you know, what I would, and then following those days, DHS and USCIS and the administration has signaled that they will and they do intend to execute a proper rescission of DACA in its coming. We'll see how soon it comes.
Do you think that it is, even though maybe not a celebration, but it is something to note, maybe a positive point along the way?
Absolutely. It's a win, right? Absolutely, it's a win. It opens up avenues of relief for individuals who priorly been awarded DACA, right? They could now renew with a bit of certainty. And as I see it, the decision, what it does, it reverts back to the 2012 DACA policy. Since the 2017 DACA policy was found to be unlawful, the rescission of it, we were now back to 2012 DACA policy, which allows for new application if you can meet the criteria of DACA. And it also allows, in my opinion, for what's called for advanced parole, which allows individuals to travel outside the country for humanitarian reasons or other reasons and gains them reentry, illegal reentry into the United States, which is a great benefit for those. So absolutely a win, but I don't believe the fight's over.
Do you think that, and particularly that last point, that this is going to be an opportunity here for those folks who came over as children but are grown-ups now that have been able to be in the United States for as long as they have, even though they're in this relatively special status, that they can still have this opportunity if the pandemic will allow them to travel, even as only as close as Mexico, we'll say, that they will still have a chance to go home, visit family and friends as safely as they can, and still be able to do so without knowing that they're going to face any retribution?
Yeah, in fact, it actually is a benefit. So the common scenario is individuals been here for X amount of years, qualify for DACA, qualifies for advanced parole, and marries a U.S. citizen. Through that, you know, there's a petition available for the U.S. citizen to petition DACA spouse and get their legal permanent residency. Through advanced parole in a court case called Yarabelli, known as Yarabelli, that legal entry on advanced parole counts to as an admittance inspection for the purposes of adjustment under 245, INA 245. So then the individual comes back, DACA recipient comes back with that legal entry, and they adjust here in the United States rather than going through a convoluted waiver process and counselor interview process in their foreign country. So it's a great benefit to be able to travel, not only to see family and introduce new family to family, but also to immigration-wise, it's a great benefit under the case law.
Do you see any benefit that's going to come for Indiana programs that affect DACA, the Dreamers, those who are involved under DACA, things like education, in particular higher education, where you have scholarships and other money that the state sends out here to benefit?
Well, we'll see. You know, right now DACA recipients have to pay foreign exchange type tuition for Indiana universities, public universities. They're treated as foreign exchange students. Mm-hmm. They're not eligible for Pell Grants or any type of federal assistance, but they do have to fill out the FAFSA and get denied. Whether, that's extended, I know there's been some There's been a bill introduced and did not make it out of committee. State Representative Earl Harris introduced a bill to allow for individuals who graduated from a Indiana high school be eligible for in-state tuition. And that would include DACA, right? That would include DACA, Dreamers, and individuals who are undocumented but went through the school system here in Indiana. So I guess we'll see how the state responds.
Let me ask, from a local standpoint here, and your practice in particular, has things picked up, so to speak, among people that you have represented in cases here in the recent months, at least, have come in to talk with you since the Supreme Court decision handed out earlier this month?
Yeah, we've seen an uptick since there was a threat to DACA. Previously to the Supreme Court case, we were advising clients to renew their DACA application or DACA status if they were coming up and renew it early, just in anticipation that the Supreme Court would find in favor of the administration. So we were pretty busy renewing DACA applicants, even if it was prior to the 150-day requested deadline. And then after the Supreme Court decision, we were inundated with phone calls for new applicants. We're getting them out ASAP with explanation at USCIS why they're eligible, even though they've never applied before. But, you know, Chris, DACA is a Band-Aid. It's not a permanent status. We've seen it. It's in flux regarding, you know, depending upon the administration in office. So what we do is we go through a detailed immigration consultation with all of our clients to see if there's a more permanent solution than just prosecutorial discretion through DACA.
So you think that maybe that what we will next see is going to probably happen on the political front with the elections coming up in November, deciding who is going to be the next president or if the current president stays in office?
I think so. It's going to be, you know, there's somewhere up in the high 70s, low 80s of approval for the DREAM Act and getting DACA recipients or DACA-type Dreamers a pathway to citizenship. So we'll see. The election is going to have a great amount of impact on that specific issue. Not only the election of the president, but, House of Rep and Senate as well, because there hasn't been immigration. The last immigration reform was in 1997. So it's time we've kind of addressed the whole picture in comprehensive immigration reform. But definitely the next elections are going to steer that issue.
Well, Alfredo, thank you very much for being with us and giving us your views and bringing us up to date locally, certainly, about the immigration front and the reaction from the U.S. Supreme Court decision that affects Dreamers, those who are under DACA. And we hope that we'll have more coming up soon, and we have a chance to talk with you again.
I appreciate it, Chris. Thanks.
We have spoken about the immigration issue and the latest decision from the U.S. Supreme Court with Alfredo Estrada. He's an attorney with Burke, Costanza, and Carberry here in Northwest Indiana. This next story is coming to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
In my high school, we had maybe 3 African-American kids in our classes. And then coming here, you know, you have everything. You have international students and just everybody. And then you hear all these stories about how people view things differently than you and how they believe. And it just is such an eye-opening experience of like thinking like, we knew in elementary school we had holiday parties and not Christmas parties, but we never knew anybody that celebrated anything but Christmas. So here it's a lot different than what I experienced growing up. I am a quarter Hispanic, and when I was in high school, that was, like, a big thing. Like, you're Mexican. And I was like, I'm a quarter, like, Mexican. That's it. I look exactly like my mom. And she's half Mexican, so we both have our darker skin tone. Growing up, my friends and all my classmates would see, oh, that's your mom? You guys are so much tanner. And they first, I'd be like, are you Italian? Are you this? Finally, I was like, you know what? Like, my dad's 100 different things. My dad has really no idea what he is. We kind of guesstimated. And my mom only knows the part that's Mexican. So that's my majority. And so eventually they were like, what are you? And I'm like, well, I'm Hispanic or Mexican. And I don't really know what else. Like, I'm Dutch, German, Irish, whatever. And that just kind of stuck. Yeah, my grandpa lived, I think, till he was 12 in Mexico and then moved to Chicago. So, I mean, he was very young for what he can remember in Mexico. I mean, my mom grew up in the 70s where you weren't proud to be Mexican. And she failed Spanish in high school. I mean, she knows words that he would speak around the house, or when she went on family trips, she went down to Mexico to visit her grandma. She can listen and understand it, but she cannot speak it at all. I have some culture parts that I identify with that are Mexican, just basically food and stuff. But then there's also parts that I identify with from my grandpa's German side, even though he's not even fully German. So I think my mom calls me a mutt. I think there's a ton of people that just don't know what they really are. They don't know what if they're Polish or German or Irish. So I don't think there's a strictly white category. I think that's just the default. But I definitely stood out being like a heavy tan kid in elementary school when I had these skinny white girls all around that were just pale and straight hair, and just, I mean, I stood out, so I guess they noticed. So everyone looked at me like that in high school, but like coming here, I'm like, I'm white. Like, and I knew that in high school, I was like, I'm just white, but everyone just would always place me under Hispanic. Yeah, it was kind of odd. And I know that if I went to Maryville, people would be like, you're white. So, I mean, growing up, it wouldn't have been an issue of what are you? So I would have been so normal if I grew up anywhere else. It's weird to think how different my life would have been if I grew up in a different town or city or school system than I did.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for joining us, and we hope you join us tomorrow.